This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another special podcast on Joy 94.9. Is David Bowie is more Bowie. Can't get enough Bowie.
This is Sonia for a Sci-Fi and Scream here on Joy 94.9. And it's all about the Bowie. It's a Bowiecology time. It's David Bowie is at ACMI or ACME here in Melbourne town. We're very lucky to have for the winter season, everything David Bowie pretty much. And on the phone line, we've got the honour of speaking to someone who is very much on the side of the Bowie, I would say. We've got Tanya Stark speaking to us from Brisbane.
Hello.
And she's going to tell us basically who she is, firstly, and how she got involved in David Bowie is.
How are you?
Very good. Very much trying to hide excitement, especially on social media, because it looks weird.
That's me trying to hide nerves. So I guess this starting point is I'm a fairly curious person and I've always been quite eclectic. So I make art. I've been a counsellor, a curator. When I was young, I worked in the music industry. In fact, I very, very briefly for a year worked at Polygram when Tin Machine was signed through that label. And I'm thinking, oh, I hope they tour Brisbane, but they never did at that time. So, look, across my life, I've always been really interested in the interplay between psychology, philosophy, spirituality, and quite fascinated with suburban gothic themes, with probably this lovely intersection with pop culture. And I guess working for a long time very early on in... Well, I came from quite a fundamentalist Christian background. Mm-hmm. I worked into social work, which was, I mean, like I say, there's your spirituality. We worked in social work, there's your suburban gothic. And then I guess I've just always asked the big questions, always been curious, always been a thinker, and loved this whole sort of the synthetic mash of all these sort of themes. And so I guess someone like that's going to be intrinsically drawn to Bowie because I guess he covers and plays with all these themes all the time.
Mm. Yes, okay. Suburban Gothic, is that what you said?
Mm.
Oh, interesting times, yes.
Mm.
Mm. No, I'm just curious about that because I do know some people who have hailed from the north and are now living, you know, they have access to the south, they're living here in Melbourne and seem to be enjoying themselves. And they do say that they all started off as a goth. In Queensland, and there was quite a nice, tight little gothic community on the Gold Coast in Brisbane.
Yes. Now, I probably wouldn't self-describe as being a goth, but being absolutely fascinated, I guess, by those same themes of, you know, of death and which is obviously another really huge theme in Bowie's work, and just these lovely ideas of what is the undercurrents in existence. And in my private life and in my professional life, I got a strong glimpse very early on into, you know, what was behind the picket fences and what was behind the facades, the shadow in suburbia, and what we are capable as humans of inflicting upon one another, you know, and I guess there's this capacity of us to inflict pain and injury both physically and emotionally upon others. And that dark side within ourselves and within society has always fascinated me. And I think that's something Bowie often touches upon at different points in his career.
I think for him, I'm just guessing, but from what I do know about his background, there was that conflict within his family and that stress that was there to do with his mother's background and her being diagnosed with schizophrenia and then later on his half-brother. So his brother had that too, and that led to some great sadness for the family and for him later in life, a lot of sadness. And I think maybe that reflects too, and that's what appeals, because he does seem to certainly generate those sort of emotions in a lot of his work. There's the so-called dark side, but I always find that side to be the most enlightening and revealing side to his work, personally.
Mm. You know? Bowie's, and I guess Bowie's never been afraid of acknowledging and playing with the shadow. And I think that shadow within all of us and in society is a really recurrent theme. And I think some people get a bit, I think they miss it with the glamour and the glitz and the glitter and they sort of forget that this man has always been exploring some of these big questions of life and death. And what you just raised about his family, I think, is a really fascinating background to and what's informed his work. And I don't think we can underplay that. I think the influence of suicides, and look, I probably wouldn't say schizophrenia at this point. I'm not even sure what schizophrenia is sometimes, but I heard Bowie describe his family's experience with psychosis and suicide as emotional and spiritual mutilation. And I thought when he sort of said, look, his family has been ravaged by a lot of emotional and spiritual mutilation, which has also touched him at points in his life, I thought that encapsulated probably one of the most fascinating ways of explaining what that fine line between genius and madness and those big questions and those dark shadows.
Yeah, because he must have wondered if he would inherit any of those or be influenced, I guess. It must have troubled him quite. Because you do wonder. I mean, I'm an adopted person and you go through a lot of your younger formative times thinking, what if, because I am a certain way, what if I've inherited something, you know, that's going to be a cause for me to not exist or not be able to exist in society, you know. And it used to really worry me a lot, especially my mental state at times. I used to think, oh boy, is there something I need to know? And then, of course, I found out that my birth father actually has autism. So it made a lot of sense to me. We're very similar. So, it was a great revelation, but it was a big challenge at the time. Yeah. But at least I knew, you know.
And look, all those things that you've just said, I think there is a real resonance for people who ask these questions and who are fascinated and intrigued by the questions of what if and what are the, you know, these big existential questions that curious minds ask. And sometimes there's even this intrinsic unconscious knowing of something that we can't quite put our fingers on, that, I guess what I'm saying is in pop culture, not many artists have managed to express and explore that struggle like Bowie. And what's fascinating is across 50 years, I think you've got this fabulous and intriguing journey of someone who is asking those same questions. Who am I? What are we here for? Is this all, you know, is this all rubbish? Is this all really meaningful?
What's that song? Is that all there is? Do you know
absolutely,
that song?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, you know, this for me, that is, I think, the people I know that are most intrinsically drawn to Bowie. It is because I think subconsciously he is asking those same questions that incurious, existential, restless minds all grapple with. You know,
And Rock and Roll Suicide is a great, amazing song which he sings at the end of the Ziggy Stardust. And I've seen the last show he did in the 70s when he killed off or said goodbye to Ziggy. And when he just screams out that, well, not scream, but he announces that you're not alone, you know. And it's like you hear that and you go, what? And then you hear the words, it's wonderful, and you think, my God, he's got the light and the dark there and reaching out, and you can grab the Bowie hand.
And that's a really, really fascinating thing, that line that you talked about, you know, all the knives, you know, seem to lacerate your brain, you know, feel that pain, I've been there, I will help that, you know, you're wonderful, you're not alone.
Yeah.
If you've ever gone through that, you know, those dark night of the souls and the despair, you crave that hand that will pull you up and actually go, I get this, I'm going to hold you through these, you are not alone. You know, you are actually beautiful despite the crazy, you know, despite, you know, this emotional and spiritual mutilation, you know, I guess is the way you put it, you know, you're not alone. The interesting thing there is, I think, from a cultural point of view, he's expressing some very, very interesting concepts there. And he was very young when he wrote this stuff.
I know.
So I guess what I'm thinking about when I want to talk about Jung and Bowie, I guess, is that he's actually exploring, and they were just sort of percolating out through him, a lot of these really deep archetypal concepts that just recur over and over again in sort of, I guess, the human life journey. And I guess one of the other things I find really fascinating is so much of what Bowie's saying, and he says he was singing in character and he was singing for other people, but he's almost so often doing this form of therapy for himself, and it's something that I think, you know, Jung spoke about, and Carl Jung, the psychologist.
Carl Jung, yes.
Who I'm quite fascinated with, and who I'll be talking about at the exhibition on the 26th as a special session, often talks about, you know, people that are really troubled and wrestling with these strong, dark, troubling dreams and issues, you know, to express them somehow, to get them out through art, to get them out through writing, to get them out through Jung didn't say music, but he himself went through some deeply, deeply troubling visions and hallucinated experiences through a very turbulent time of his life. And he basically said, look, it is so imperative that you find a way to express these, that you find a way to unpack your myths, that you find a way to work out what your narratives are that you're wrestling with, and that you put them out. And for Jung, it was, you know, personally, he created something called the Red Book, and over a period of 4 years, he wrote out his visions and his, you know, hallucinations is a strong word, but certainly this very deeply visionary experience that he went into. Some people call it active imagination. But, you know, for a period of 4 years, every afternoon, he was wrestling with this onslaught of, he would say, the unconscious and the unconscious imagery and this archetypal imagery that was emerging, and he collated into what was called the Red Book, and the Red Book is Jung's journey, almost of the descent into this world of the unconscious, or as Bowie might say, the subterranean world, you know, the underground. And we see this sort of work going over and over and over again in Bowie's work, is this you know, percolation, this wrestle, and then this dive into
the labyrinth
of the unconscious.
The underground, the song, you know, that's there too. And to think children are exposed to this, you know, it's lucky
and
kids.
Yet,
I mean, it's, you know, it's interesting.
That is a fabulous movie. That is a really deeply, look, it's Tim, and you know, funnily enough, I didn't watch it when it first came out. It was something that I guess I could probably avoid, thinking it was a Muppet movie, and that was a mistake. I came to it later in life.
Have you seen Dark Crystal? Have you seen The Dark Crystal?
No, I haven't seen that either.
That's a Muppet movie, but it's just incredible. It's so dark. It's just so painful to watch, but it's beautiful, you know, and it's got all the archetypes, and it's just amazing, the trials and tribulations of a female and a male. They're like elfins or some sort. Really amazing. I was skeptical, and then I watched it, and I was like, wow, this is very cool. You know?
And I guess there is something about getting older, and you go back and look at the fairy tales, you go back and look at the mythologies of our culture, when you go back and look at movies that may have seemed like child stories, and you go,
that makes sense.
These are deeply, deeply archetypal images and patterns and
stories often very disturbed.
And wrestles that, you know, go over and over and over again in our lives. And, you know, in Labyrinth, I think it's a fascinating movie of someone who actually has to descend into their darkest, fierce desires. I mean, initially she wants this child out of her life, and she gets what she wants. Mm. But did she know that's what she wanted? And she has to dive deep into this subterranean world of her unconscious. And it's deeply mesmerizing and complex and troubling all at the same time. And at the very end, it's this beautiful way, I think, and this is the wisdom of that movie, in that the only way out of the labyrinth for her was being able to visualize, actualize, fully confront and acknowledge the shadow, which was Bowie's character in that movie, understand that it had this capacity to almost want to rule and overtake her. And as much as that was deeply, deeply seductive, she pulled herself together, was able to almost integrate that understanding that, okay, you are a projection of my darkest, deepest fears and wants and desires, but you cannot rule over me. You know, I have to hold my power, knowing that you are there, you are real, my desires and my fears and my, you know, all these unconscious things are percolating are there. But that pivotal point in the movie where she's able to say, you have no power over me, is such a wonderful analogy to, I think, some of the twists and turns and dead ends that we often find in our own lives, and that it might be our addictions, or it might be our obsessions, or it might be our, you know, the dark stuff that comes out in our own heads, you know, at night, and it's just what we, you know, that we wrestle with, and they may be very, very, very simple, they might be very, very dark and deep, but we almost have to make sure, I guess, in our own life that we are able to see the shadow for what it is, respect it, understand that it's deeply, deeply seductive, but keep it in its place. And remember, we integrate to move on, but we fully subsume ourselves to that to that power, it then controls us, and that's, I think, a very dangerous place to be. So that's a powerful movie.
It's pretty, well, they'll be playing it fairly regularly, I think, all the way to right through the whole, well, it's, I guess it's one of the longest Bowie festivals that we'll see in the Southern Hemisphere till November. So, you know, it's a big undertaking, and it's interesting just talking to people and getting to interview people like yourself. It's just coming across that really strong, it's more than fandom, it's just that realization, I guess, that for, and being a man as well, you know, he identifies as a cisgender man, but he's explored different aspects of sexuality in his time, of course. It's interesting that everyone can use him as a touchstone for some other things that we can all say, look, that's influenced me. Maybe that's why I went on ahead and did that in my career, or think about things in that, or like that music in that way.
Yeah. And look, he is a reflector. That's one of the interesting things that visionary artists often do, is because they're almost expressing through creative form these archetypal images. Mm. They reflect back to us the narratives of our lives, and we unconsciously pick that up, I think, in pop culture, and we go, wow. You know, I think the old ancient Greek mythologies and, you know, those narratives of the gods and Zeus and, you know, these old narratives sort of don't seem to resonate for our culture anymore, but we find it in pop culture, and in someone like Bowie, these same stories percolate over and over and over again. Mm. And look, this fascinating. And look, I guess the fact that he's asked spiritual and fascinating real questions, and hasn't necessarily settled for easy answers. He's actually been really wrestling with, you know, you said earlier, the light and the dark, and this wrestle to find an integrated way to synthesize, or almost a third way, which is quite a Jungian thing. It's moving out of sort of duality into a non-duality space. And that's a very difficult thing, to stop seeing the world in sort of binaries and actually start looking at this integrated space where things are neither good nor bad, but they are what they are. There is almost a third way. And that stuff comes through. So something like Ashes to Ashes, explores that tension between the light and the dark, and this being torn between being grounded and being torn between being, you know, set adrift, and that sort of that conflict and that tension in the middle of it. And one of the fascinating things, I guess, in my research around Jung and Bowie is Bowie across his life, sort of in his 90s, started saying, look, and I guess he always said this in different ways, but he started saying, look, someone asked him, look, you know, has spirituality played much a role in your writing? And he says, look, it's been a recurrent qualification of my work from the day I started. Mm. And he was asked to give an early example of a spiritual song, and he said Space Oddity, which you kind of go, what? And then he sort of said, look, well, Word on a Wing is obvious, but, you know, he's basically saying Space Oddity is a spiritual song. And so when we start looking at Space Oddity, Word on a Wing, Ashes to Ashes, outside with all its, you know, interesting, messy, heretical brilliance, right through to the next day, Bowie's wrestling with these really fascinating questions of existence and light and death and darkness another fascinating thing he said is he's always questioned his spiritual life. And he's found a sort of a form of Gnostic Christianity and atheism have always been quite important to him. And he sort of says he's oscillated between the two and sort of moved through that tension. And that, again, is a fascinating space. So for people who are sort of probably at the more atheistic end of the spectrum or somewhere at the spiritual end of the spectrum, that tension in between the two comes out in his work. And it's, you know, at different points in his life, you can see it ebbing, you can see it flowing. Mm. And I would say, for me, and this is just my interpretation, not anybody else's, but for me, I see then, in my theory, in my thesis, I guess, that Bowie's iconic and recurring space imagery legitimately can be understood as spiritual metaphors for the age-old themes of alienation and enlightenment. And they're all archetypes of, you know, the pilgrimage, the tension and the search, that whole outer space is inner space thing. And, you know, all that cosmology that he, you know, over and over goes with, stars and suns and Sirius moonlight, it's almost, there's new layers or new symbolism and contemporary reimaginings of these old mythologies. And that, I think, that really fascinating synthesis of the mythopoeic themes of the unconscious combined with the zeitgeist of pop culture around the struggle for meaning, the catharsis, knowledge, probably not even putting it very well, but I guess this is, I think, for me, why Bowie has been such a really resonant character in pop culture consciousness, because this is a new way of dealing with old mythologies, and it's coming out in a way that I guess our culture understands, but without understanding, you know. And I think it's fascinating, absolutely fascinating territory, you know. And the other thing is, this is just my interpretation. It's not necessarily Bowie's interpretation, it's not anybody else's interpretation, but it's for me, an interesting way I interpret the narrative of Bowie's wrestles across 15 years. And I love that this is a man who hasn't been scared to ask big questions. I won't say I love it, but I'm intrigued. I think we are very privileged. And I guess it's horrible for him, but we are privileged as an audience to have watched someone fall so darkly and deeply into quite a dangerous space and watch him pull himself back out through his creative work. And I don't think we can minimise how personally taxing and what a toll that would have been for him, but how much of a gift he has given us as a culture.
It does remind me of, if he had been just a painter, because I know he paints as well, but if he'd gone along the career of a painter or purely musician, I don't think he would have survived. Perhaps if he hadn't had that strength of his commitment and understanding of like those Jungian ideas and archetypes and all those sorts of things, or he just happened to be happenstance. He may have been learning along those things the way that a lot of people do. But I just had the image of, I think it's a Van Gogh painting. It might have been when he was with Gauguin when they were working side by side. But it's of Jacob wrestling the angel. It's very strong. I don't know if you know that image.
Profound.
But,
yes, I do.
But it's Gauguin, but it's so Van Gogh as well. And it's got all of those elements. And, of course, Gauguin survived, sort of.
But don't we all just sort of survive? I mean,
no, Van Gogh didn't.
This journey without being really, really scarred through those wrestles. And I think, you know, we see Dante's Inferno, we see Faust, we see, you know, we see Jacob wrestling with angels, we see these really interesting metaphorical struggles through Bowie's work. And I think people miss it sometimes because it can be so poppy. And yet, I don't think there's anything wrong with also being an artist. You can also just make art, or even not even just art, you can just make music for fun. You don't always have to be in the darkest space. But certainly he has, and we have had the privilege of watching him wrestle through the dark stuff. And that torture is fascinating. You know, and what you just said about that painting, Jacob wrestling, you know, Jacob wouldn't let that God's blessing. And interestingly, through so much of his work, we see him wrestling with angels. You know, there's angels that are making, angels of light, there's angels of death, there's angels that came to him and, you know, looking back in anger, and they perpetually reemerge. You know, these angels and demons and this sort of really beautiful symbolist imagery.
Who's Joe the Lion? Do you know?
Joe the Lion is I understand, a performance artist / painter who once pinned himself to a VW Beetle, and I believe he recently died.
Oh, I'll have to look that up. Oh.
Yeah, look, I'm not 100% sure. There he is.
Yeah, I've always wondered who Joe was.
Look, I could be wrong. And, you know, if I was a nerd, I would Google it. And I have to say that's probably a little slight gap in my understanding. But I understand that he's a performance artist in the 70s who was quite well known for at one point crucifying himself onto the top of his car.
Goodness me.
Because that line, nail me to my car and I'll tell you who you are. So,
yeah.
Ritual sacrifice.
Yeah, there's a lot of that, and animal animisms and things like that. Like when he's Diamond Dog and the front cover, the gatefold, you open it and he's half dog. And what was that all about? You know, it's like, what was that about? You know, makes you wonder.
Oh, well, if you actually go back to I think it's 1890s, there's this painting called The Caress that was done at, you know, it was a symbolist painting, and for the life of me, my brain has just slipped the art name of the artist. But it's of a woman hybrid with a leopard, and it's done also by...
Is it Moreau?
Moreau? It had been really... If you gave me 2 seconds, I'd probably pull it up a couple of... I'm having a blank. But it is a brilliant parallel to that same image. And both of them were done by Belgian artists and 100 years apart. And it's very similar iconography. And this interesting... I think it's the word theromorphic. Mm. You know, that sort of that link between the animal and the beast, which is, again, the minotaur. And this minotaur concept that comes up over and over again in Bowie's work, this beast within, or, you know, and I think you see it in, you know, Beauty and the Beast. It's our outer and our inner. And
he does sing Beauty and the Beast, doesn't he? And the trilogy, Lodger and Low and Heroes, there is a lot of that coming through. I don't know how much of that was the drugs, but it does come through strongly about the conflict between the animal side of humanness and being in this very structured difficult world, which he was when he was at the Hansa Studios, you know. Mm-hmm. I like to think that it was his fault, or a good fault, that has helped to bring down the Berlin Wall. That would be good to know. where was he that night, you know? guilty.
And we'll never know this. And, you know, I guess the other thing is, like, we as an audience are perceiving Bowie, the artist, working through his art to process his inner stuff. And Bowie may not necessarily across those 50 years say, this is who I am and this is what I'm wrestling with. He will often say, I'm inhabiting a character and I'm sometimes just doing a theatrical piece. But I think within that you can draw a narrative of the very fact that you are using characters, continually taking on roles and doing theatrical pieces, you know, when I say that inverted commas, is in itself part of the autobiography of who this person is. And that's the fascinating thing, this you know, our personas, our reasons why we inhabit or don't inhabit certain spaces or different, you know, different faces. And look, his enigma and his multifaceted aspects is that's the magic of Bowie. It's the enigmatic, not being able to quite put your finger on stuff. But I guess he's also saying, look, these are narratives, these are mythologies of my own, these are my own struggles, or these are, you know, sort of archetypal human struggles. They overlay with our own personal experiences. So all of us, I guess, have songs that resonate for a reason that we can't quite put our finger on, but gee, they touch us.
And then there's the next Bowie. Duncan Jones' son. Okay, because Moon, hello. Source Code, and now he's doing Warcraft. You know, he's doing the film version, live action of Warcraft video game. So, yeah, look, really, really interesting. It's kind of, well, it's the family business, isn't it? To be amazing.
Family mythology, maybe.
An
interesting metaphorical archetypal.
So it'll be interesting how we can do something like Warcraft. Do you know the game at all? Do you know?
Oh, I'm going to sound like it.
No, that's okay. They're epic. They're epic. They're basically very epic. You know, they're very epic. They're very multi-layer. They're too hard to do in a film, I would imagine. But maybe they've got the right person to do it. It'll be interesting. It'll have all those archetypes, you know, heroes, villains. It has the fantasy element, let's face it. It is giant fantasy, epic monstrosity made into a video game that people can participate in and be any of those characters, and they're going to make it into a film. So it'll be interesting. They're due to have it out next year, but we'll see. These things can take a lot longer, especially when they have to compromise to try and make money back. So, but yeah, Duncan Jones, I've watched him carefully. I mean, he hasn't been so prolific, but I saw Moon and I was just blown away. It was like, is this Major Tom? I was like, oh, have you seen it? Do you know?
No, I haven't. Oh,
no. Okay, I won't spoil it then. But really,
I've got a list of about 30
need
movies
to see.
I've yet to see, and they're sitting there just going.
Yeah, it's
I'd almost
just
need a weekend marathon where I do nothing but sit in my house with coffee and wine potentially and just watch movies. So.
It's a very singular film. It's something you have to maybe observe alone. Because it's all about that, and it is. I wonder if it is Major Tom, and he's in space. I don't want to spoil it because it is amazing. It came out in 2009, and there wasn't a lot of sci-fi of great real interest. And it's not sci-fi that has to have lock and load, or, you know, it doesn't have to have all the action around it. He's a major in philosophy, so, you know, again, that's must be genetic.
There's something just fabulous. I have never met a person who's been, you know, fascinated with Bowie who isn't also simultaneously fascinated with psychology and philosophy and these, you know, these really interesting questions of life and what are we here for and what's this all about and how do I, maybe not how, why, if, what, but it's just this curious mind. And Bowie will resonate, I think, for people like us, consciously or not. I think we often find, look, everyone I've spoken to who's been quite notably drawn to Bowie has been drawn at a very early age. And I was 8 when I saw Ashes to Ashes, a very, very small girl. That was my first film clip as a very tiny girl, looked at it and was just spellbound, captivated, completely just locked on, going, what am I
can't doing? Remember the first time. He's always been there. So I can't can't really remember. He's just been like the eccentric English father, if I had an eccentric English father. But I also just had a thought that perhaps that's what he is. He represents, I don't know personally what he represents to a lot of people of colour and other cultures, but for English-speaking cultures, people who do know the English tongue and use it, and that includes lots of different cultures now, of course, too. He's very much like, to me, if it was like the Victorian age would meet the 21st century, it would have a working class lad who did very well. And I mean, for a working class lad, he's not an academic. He's not coming from that. He's coming purely as an artist.
Yes.
At first, maybe a musician, but no, he's a living artist, and we're very lucky he's still alive, and it's awesome.
Yes. We are really lucky he's still alive, and I think that much as, and the question's been asked quite a few times, like, why is this man being celebrated like this? Why are we doing this big exhibition? What is this all about? Is this just this cultural creation of an Elvis? And it's, I guess the question, well, not the question, I guess the thought for me, and I've often wondered, and it's funny, I almost these days am less of a fan, and fan's probably a strange word, I probably was, the less I looked into him, less a fan and more of an intrigued observer who's kind of went, this has been a privilege to watch this unfold over 50 years, and we haven't had very many cultural, pop culture icons that we can say that we've
who've seen survived,
that creative
again,
stuff that has survived. That
exists,
still
that's still that are existing and exist, so we do know that they're still on the same planet, we think, and and within communication, not as accessible perhaps, but we do know that communicate, this is his way, I think, of communicating with us.
Yeah.
It does sound like the alien communicating, but I think it is. It is the alien. We are aliens. Let's be honest here. Like, every time you see a sci-fi, some sci-fi films and TV, it's always like the humans are out there, but we're not aliens. You know, we're not. We're the explorers. We're the pioneers. It's a very Eurocentric kind of cultural way of looking at things, but it's like, I don't think we need to. I think we're all aliens and we're all living amongst each other. And I think David Bowie's a great example of an alien amongst us, amongst other aliens.
And I think the other thing is we are so often unaware of the aliens within ourselves. And that's what that exploration, I guess, and that Jungian exploration of you know, the inner self. And that Bowie, I think, has done a lot through his work, consciously and subconsciously, unconsciously, I should say, is looking for that alien sort of inside.
Loving the alien. And
yes.
I love that song. It's a troubling song. It's problematic. It's, I don't know what it's really about, but because he mentions Templars and Saracens, he must have been looking into the Crusades or something. But then it becomes something totally different. When you look at the cover, you think, what is that? He's a blue person way before Avatar. So,
well, I was going to say that blue person is like the Indian god that's blue. I can't even remember.
There's Shiva.
One of them. And I think Shiva? That I think there's just that blue-coloured skin that you see a lot in Indian mythology or Indian religion or Hindu religion. I think there's a link there.
And he's got a stained glass window behind him, which
absolutely
is very Catholic.
Very Catholic.
Because I'm not from a Catholic background. I'm from, you know, I'm a proddy hopper.
Yeah,
by origin, sadly.
I'm a recovering Baptist. It's okay.
Oh yeah, you know, I'm the same. We're called priority hoppers by other genres.
That's right.
We're just, you know, different science fiction clubs, as I call them. Our religion. Oh yes, there's a funny little science fiction club over there, and there's that other little science fiction club over there. More fiction than science, but anyway. Interesting albums. Oh, I mean, the artwork itself. All the albums are like coded, and I love it. It's just interesting.
You have to really
think about it. It's not just a picture of the person who's made the music. So what are you doing? You're doing the Artist Labyrinth. That is happening. Is it Strange Fascinations? Is that where you come in?
Yeah, that is. And look, pretty much everything we've just talked about is what I'm pretty much going to be talking about.
Right. Pretty much.
So we've pretty much nailed it. We're looking at all that archetypal stuff. And so for me, I believe that Bowie is equally connected with Carl Jung. I think that Carl Jung has provided a very interesting compass as Bowie's navigating, you know, ways of understanding spirituality and life and, you know, these big questions. Look, I'm doing a talk It's actually called Crashing Out with Sylvian, and it's the link between David Bowie, Carl Jung, and the unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
And what I guess I'm exploring is the relationship and the linkages, I guess, between the ideas of Carl Jung as explored in the work of David Bowie. Mm-hmm. And we know, I guess, and it might not be well known, but Bowie speaks and reads Jung quite passionately. In fact, when his new album came out, Tony Ausler, you know, gave an interview where he said, look, you know, Bowie speaks and writes of Carl Jung, you know, with a passion. And if you go back through his work, you start seeing these overt and symbolic references to Jung all over the career, all over his career. There's this beautiful quote, and I'm going to read it out to you, I think, mm-hmm. because it's better than me trying to remember it. And Bowie says, well, he self-identifies as Jungian. And I think this is interesting. He said, I suspect that dreams are an integral part of existence with far more use for us than we've made of them, really. I'm quite Jungian about that. The dream state is a strong, active, potent force in our lives. The fine line between the dream state and reality is at times for me quite grey, and combining the two, the places where the two worlds come together, has been an important thing in some of the things that I've written. So my talk looks at Bowie's long-term fascination with Jung, introduces some of Jung's ideas, and then we look at this explanation of the links between Bowie and Jung. Mm. I'm not sure if you know Bowie sings about Carl Jung on the Aladdin Sane album. There's a line in Drive-In Saturday where he described Jung, Jung the foreman, prayed at work.
Mm.
And that's interesting because on that album, that's the Aladdin Sane, which is the pun on Aladdin Sane. I think so we know he was reading it, he was singing about Jung, but I think across those five decades of work, we see these Jungian concepts and archetypal ideas, you know, from the struggle around the individuation and the integration of opposites in Ashes to Ashes, from the confrontation to the shadow and Beauty and the Beast, which we spoke about earlier, to this complex relationship with the numinous. And in my talk, I'll be suggesting that Bowie's creative and synchronistic manifestations of archetypes and, I guess, the intuitive openness to Jung's idea of the collective unconsciousness, and we see that in that cut-up technique and allowing just things to percolate and dealing and being happy with a bit of chaos and sort of letting things unfold and being comfortable with the idea of spontaneous and interesting mistakes and being comfortable with that. I think that's where we see Bowie and drawing from the dream world. We see this, and I believe we see this idea of his personal and collective unconscious manifesting, and that's, again, what I keep saying around this idea that's why we're unconsciously picking up and feeling this in Bowie's work, because it's resonating with our own collective unconscious stuff. And again, I think that wrestling with the spirituality and meaning and existence has been this pervasive theme. And questioning his spiritual life has always been fascinating. And I guess Carl Jung, you know, almost 100 years ago, you know, he was fascinated with the mytho-spiritual dimensions of the psyche in the context of emotional health and psychological integration. Mm. And I guess when we think of Jung, we think of, he coined the concept of synchronicity, or the word synchronicity, and he gave us the ideas of introversion and extroversion, which we often know from the Myers-Briggs personality type indicator. Jung was fascinated with religion and esoteric spirituality. He explored the occult. He's fascinated in alchemy, mythology, and even the UFO phenomenon. And I guess he delved into these areas in a quest to understand human behaviour and mental illness.
Mm.
And in fact, that was sort of part of the reason that he split ultimately with Sigmund Freud, is that he had a bit more of an encompassing, mythical, spiritual view of the human psyche, whereas sort of Freud was just a little less, probably as more mystical than Jung. So for me, this Jungian stuff, and I guess in my talk I'll probably go through just a little bit more about how Jung understands what the collective unconscious is, what is individuation, and what are these ideas of the archetypes. And look, some of these archetypes, and let me explain this, Jung, I guess, saw that the unconscious, and this is the sort of the world of images and ideas and concepts that sort of percolate beneath the surface, they take the form of archetypal images. And these are like these thematic ideas that come through dream, art, myth, and narrative. And we, from these, we get things like the hero, the savior, the trickster, you know, apocalyptic ideas are sort of an archetypal image. But Jung placed recurring emphasis on several of these archetypal images that you see over and over again in the work of Bowie. And Jung's very strong ones were the persona, the anima and the animus, the shadow and the self. And these were probably core archetypal images that, you know, that are expressed in the human experience over and over again. And I think you, when you look at Bowie, you see the persona, you see the anima and the animus, you see the shadow, and you see this, you know, this journey around self pulsating very, very strongly in his work. Interestingly, you'll notice that over-identification with archetypes could be very problematic. And I think we notice at different points that Bowie, being sort of intrinsically poetical and drawn to, you know, these fascinating ideas, and sometimes early, particularly, he wasn't sort of bounded, I guess, by as much grounding as he might be now.
Probably well, he was Ziggy. He did think he was Ziggy at some point, according to some eyewitness accounts. And then, of course, with the drug incidences, and that did spiral, and he lost a lot of followers, fans, in that respect. But maybe, yeah, maybe now he's starting to settle into who he is and settling for that's what he is instead of, and this is something that I think is so, it's fundamentally important for people who are, for want of a better word, may have some ego overdevelopment in some areas, you know, to have a look at the life of David Bowie. David Bowie is them, you know. They need to, well, they're not him, obviously, but maybe they need to go along to the event and find out. I mean, we all probably can learn something from that, you know, from that experience, those experiences.
Well, it's an inability to find peace with just being present. And people who are attracted to Gnosticism, I mean, look, I've looked into it, I just think it's very interesting, but it can be in itself its own head fuck and its own prison, just as much as fundamentalism, just as much as Catholicism, just as much as anything. In the end, you've just got to find your own peace. You know, this is who I am.
You can end up with the shriveled hand. Don't want that. I'll tell you about it when you come to Melbourne.
Glad we talked.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much.
I could talk all day. All right, awesome. See you later.
Thanks, Tanya Stark. Thanks for speaking to us. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the special podcast about David Bowie.
It included many of the folks who were at ACMI and the David Bowie Is forums and exhibitions, held only in Melbourne until November 1st, 2015. We hope you enjoyed this. We'll have more podcasts to come.
Thank you for listening to the special David Bowie presentation by Joy 94.9.
Interviews helmed by Sonia Hammer from Sci-Fi and Scream and Queer Geeks of Oz and Geek Girls Speak, and Emily Dwyer and Patrick Whalen-Smith from Joy 94.9, and Lauren Stardust herself. Interviews by Lauren Stardust and Sonia Hammer for Joy 94.9. Enjoy this podcast.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.